Alt NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from AT&T, the passion to invent, the drive to deliver. The new AT&T, your world delivered.
The following is an installment of Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
A couple of months ago, my friend Tim and I duck into this restaurant on Avenue A for an early evening snack. The place is pretty crowded, but as soon as we walk in, a waitress is there to greet us. A beautiful, smiling waitress, who keeps smiling even after I make it clear to her that the table she wants to put us at in the back is absolutely unacceptable. She simply picks the menus back up and pleasantly sashays us over to the table I point to in the front. Now, I'm not trying to be difficult, but what is the point of eating in an open window restaurant if you can't sit at the window? By the time she brings us our drinks, both Tim and I are already in love with her. She is exactly what you want in a waitress. Funny, flirtatious, and attentive. A real asset to a place like this. But the boss doesn't think so. When she approaches the register to cash out an order, he snatches the credit card out of her hand and snaps, "Can't you move any f***ing faster?" If this transaction bothers our heroine, she certainly doesn't let it show. For when she comes to take our order, she is still flashing her lovely, radiant smile. As we wait for our food, we witness two more altercations with the awful boss man. He actually says to her that if she can't move her fat ass, he'll have to kick it. So when she comes by with our food, I offer an unsolicited observation that things are perhaps not as they should be. For the first time, her smile cracks. "What do you mean?" she says. I guess she thinks I'm criticizing her performance. I hastily explain myself that I don't think it's appropriate for her boss to be so demeaning and condescending. Now, the expression on her face suggests that this is perhaps the very first time that she is cognizant that these scenes with her and the boss are being noticed, observed. She starts to deflate, right there in front of us. The smile totally disappears. Tim and I eat our food in silence. It isn't even fun to look out the window. And then there's another altercation. Once again, she brings an order to the register, and once again, the boss snatches it from her hands. He tells her that it's her fault that everything is backed up, and that she's lucky that he takes pity on retarded people. I can tell that she knows that I know that she knows that I am watching her. She says, very matter-of-factly, "I don't want you to talk to me like that anymore." "Or what?" he says, without even bothering to look up at her. "Or I'll quit." "Go right ahead," he says. She stands there for a moment, and then slowly turns around and walks back into the kitchen. When she finally emerges from the kitchen, she's no longer wearing her apron. There are tears in her eyes. I take a $20 bill out of my pocket and motion for Tim to give me another one. She approaches the boss. "I guess that's it," she says. "Like I give a damn," he says, again, without even looking up at her. As she walks past us, I grab her arm. "Excuse me," I say. "We really want you to know that despite what he thinks, you really are a great waitress." I hold out the $40 to her. She starts to cry. No, I can't. Please, I plead. "You have to take it. It's your last tip." Okay, perhaps that wasn't the thing to say, and for a moment it seems that she might not take the money. I'm so frantic, I'm ready to leap up out of my chair and stuff the two $20 bills down her shirt. But before I have to do this, she snatches the money and rushes out into the street. In September 1925, Werner Heisenberg was in Copenhagen. A year earlier, Niels Bohr had invited him to be his research assistant, and now Werner Heisenberg was ready to deliver. He was ready to lay down the principles of what he called complete quantum mechanics. Heisenberg's new theory was a radical departure from previous attempts to solve atomic problems. He wrote in a 1925 letter, "My entire efforts go towards killing off and suitably replacing the concept of the orbital paths that one cannot observe." By March of 1926, Heisenberg had made enough headway to postulate a formula that banished unobservables once and for all. The principle of uncertainty. This was the foundation of what became known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. The uncertainty principle is taken to mean that, on an elementary level, the physical universe does not exist in a deterministic form, but rather as a collection of probabilities. For example, the pattern produced by millions of photons passing through a diffraction slit can be calculated using quantum mechanics, but the exact path of each photon cannot be predicted by any known method. The Copenhagen interpretation holds that it cannot be predicted by any method, not even with theoretically infinitely precise measurements. It is this interpretation that Einstein questioned when he said, "I cannot believe that God would choose to play dice with the universe." Bohr, who was one of the authors of the Copenhagen interpretation, retorted, "Einstein, don't tell God what to do." Einstein was convinced that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle was an error. His reasoning was that all previously known probability distributions arose from deterministic events. A flipped coin has a probability distribution, 50% heads or 50% tails, but this does not mean that their physical motions are unpredictable. Ordinary mechanics can in fact be used to calculate exactly how each coin will land, if the forces acting on it are known. Einstein postulated that there must be similar hidden variables in quantum mechanics, which underlie the observed probabilities, and that these variables, when known, would prove the opposite of the uncertainty principle, that all objects already have their properties before they are observed. Scientists are still debating the argument between Einstein and Heisenberg, but to date, it seems that Heisenberg's view has been the better at explaining physical subatomic phenomena, and thus the better at explaining the true nature of things.
So I leave the restaurant and I'm crying and I think that everybody's staring at me, even though of course they're probably not, but I can't help it. I've never had something like this happen to me before and I really just don't know what I'm gonna do. I have four roommates, but two of them are usually never there. It's usually just me and this girl, Elsie. And I was hoping that she wouldn't be there, but of course she is. And so I don't really have any choice but to tell her about, you know, what happened to me. Because obviously my face is all blotchy and, you know, I have tears running down my face. But she doesn't give me any sympathy at all. In fact, she starts giving me attitude, like, you know, "Oh, good job. How the hell are you going to pay for your rent?" You know, she's just like, you know, "Don't think I'm going to cover for you. You know, nobody's going to bail you out of this." I've actually lent this girl money before, but, you know, I just don't think this has anything to do with me. It has to do with her. You see, we're both painters, and, well, you know, that's kind of where the comparisons end, because, see, I'm in shows, and I actually sell paintings, and she has yet to even have a show, so clearly this attitude has nothing to do with me. It totally has to do with her. So I call her out on it. You know, I tell her that just because she has no talent, she shouldn't take it out on me. And it escalates, and she calls me a cunt, and I tell her she should give up pretending that she's an artist. And then she walks over to the wall and takes down this painting of mine, and f***ing puts her fist through it.
This is the very painting I've just sold to this dealer guy I know. Granted, he probably just wants to sleep with me, but $2,000 is more than I've ever made from any of my paintings before. I don't even say anything. I mean, this is just too much. I don't know what to do with this day anymore. I go to my friend Tom's. It's the only place I can think to go, and we go way back. We went to Pratt together. So I tell him what happened with Elsie, and he's totally cool about it. You know, he says I can crash on his couch for a while, and we smoke a joint, and I'm kind of telling him about what happened, all the details at the restaurant, and he's very comforting, and, you know, a little too comforting, I guess. And the next thing I know, you know, we're high and naked, and then his girlfriend walks in. It's like out of a movie. I mean, she gets a knife out of the kitchen and starts threatening to cut his dick off. He just pulls the bedsheet over his head, like totally not taking this seriously. So she starts jabbing the knife at me. So I run out of the apartment. I'm terrified. I'm putting my clothes on in the hallway, out of the door, you know, one leg in the pan. I have no idea what the hell I'm going to do. And then I come across this dude. He's kind of like whispering to me, you know, trying to get my attention. He says he has some crystal meth. And I've actually done meth before, to tell you the truth. You know, staying up all night at this point seems like a great idea since I don't have anywhere to go. And so, you know, I figure I'll buy some and go to a bar somewhere and write a new life plan or something like that in my journal. And of course, that's not what happens. 2 weeks later, I'm a crank addict, and I'm crashing with this dealer dude who lives with, like, the Adams family. Everybody is on SSI and crank. I mean, these people were more disgusting than the gutter punks you always see in Tompkins Square Park. Which is why one day I just go there to Tompkins. Right when I get there, I see this guy sitting on a bench reading a book, and he's smoking a cigar, so, you know, I figure he's probably got some money in his pocket, so I try to bum a dollar.
The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is frequently but incorrectly confused with the observer effect. This is what happens when an observation of an event changes the event. For example, an electron, when observed, will change its path because the observing light contains energy that disturbs it. In quantum mechanics, if the outcome of an event has not been observed, it can only then exist in a state of superposition, which is all possible states at once. This is most famously illustrated by Erwin Schrödinger's thought experiment. A cat is placed in a sealed box. Attached to the box is an apparatus containing a radioactive atomic nucleus and a canister of poison gas. The experiment is set up so that there is exactly a 50% chance of the nucleus decaying in 1 hour. If the nucleus decays, it will emit a particle that triggers the apparatus, which opens the canister and thus kills the cat. If the nucleus does not decay, then the cat remains alive. According to quantum mechanics, the unobserved nucleus is described as a superposition, meaning it exists partly as each simultaneously, of decayed nucleus and undecayed nucleus. However, when the box is opened, the experimenter observes only a decayed nucleus / dead cat or a undecayed nucleus / living cat. The question is thus, when does the system stop existing as a mixture of states and become one or the other? According to the Copenhagen interpretation, a system stops being a superposition of states when an observation takes place. So, until the box is opened, the cat is both alive and dead. This is why the physicist Stephen Hawking has said, "When I hear of Schrödinger's cat, I reach for my revolver." Hawking is of the mind that the role of the observer has been grossly overemphasized by the Copenhagen interpretation, and that so-called thought experiments like Schrödinger's cat unnecessarily complicate and mystify quantum mechanics. but to date, there is no scientific consensus regarding the role of the observer. In fact, returning to Schrödinger's cat, some scientists offer a more intuitive interpretation that the observation is taken when a particle from the nucleus hits the detector. Recent developments in quantum physics show that measurements of quantum phenomena taken by non-conscious observers, such as a wiretap, most definitely alter the quantum state of the phenomena from the point of view of the conscious observers reading the wiretap, lending support to this idea. Which brings us back to the story about the waitress. According to the Copenhagen interpretation, I played an active role in the story. In other words, I was the observer effect. For it was my observation that took away the waitress's superposition, as well as her position in the restaurant. And finding her homeless and begging in Tompkins Square Park a few weeks later confirmed my worst fears and daydreams. My observations had set off a chain of disastrous and painful events. And obviously, in the court of divine justice, $40 is most likely not going to be taken as adequate compensation.
Off the street.
Yeah, I guess. At least there's that. That's actually one thing I really wanted to ask you.
Okay, what is it?
That day when you were at the restaurant, why didn't you just say something to the owner?
You've been listening to Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. For more information, an audio archive, and a blog, visit toeradio.org.
Alt, alt, alt. Alt, alt, alt.